Copyright notice. The contents of this podcast, including intro music, are copyright Phantom Femme. The podcast artwork is copyright Isabeau of WAGProductions.org. This labyrinth, the Phantom of the Opera, in Eric's times, and ours. Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to In This Labyrinth. We're at episode 13. Wow. And as always, thanks hugely to everyone who's been listening from the beginning. And of course, welcome and thanks to everyone who's newly tuning in now. I'm so glad you're all listening and enjoying the show. And in particular, I hope you all enjoyed, or will enjoy if you're new to the show and haven't had a chance to listen to it yet, the special, slightly different episode I did last week where I interviewed my very awesome friend and colleague Bridget Liang about their newly published young adult novel. And if you did enjoy that, please do let me know, and I'll let you know all the ways you can do that at the end of this episode. Because interviews like that with fellow fans, fan artists, fan bloggers, fan authors, etc., are something I'd really love to do more of. Because I'd really love this show to be a place for a variety of different voices in the fan community, not just mine. But, of course, I want to know if that's something you all would enjoy as well. So yeah, let me know if that's something that would be of interest to you, my listeners, or if you have any other thoughts or feedback on the show as well, things you'd like to hear me talk about or requests, suggestions, etc. I can't obviously promise that I'll necessarily be able to do them, but I definitely love to hear folks' ideas. And as I said, I'll let you know all the ways that you can connect with this show at the end of the episode. So, on that note, I hope you'll all really enjoy the episode I've got for you now. I'm certainly going to enjoy it, because I'm finally getting to my long-promised review of The Angel's Flight, the sequel to The Angel's Shadow that I reviewed way back just before Christmas. Just before I actually get to that, though, I wanted to mention again, because I forgot last episode, that I'm up on Patreon now at www.patreon.com/phantomfemme. That's Phantom, Phantom, Femme. And if you enjoy the show, I would be really grateful for your support if you're in a position to be able to pledge a little bit to my Patreon. That would be super helpful. It can be as little as $1 a month, but it would help me cover the cost of things like paying for the hosting, recouping the cost of some of the audio equipment that I use to record the show, or the gorgeous poster versions of the podcast artwork that I had made up to give away as thank you gifts to interviewees, or other guests like Bridget, whom I had on last episode. But also, it would be really nice to be able to offer at least a bit of decent payment to those who help me make the visual presentation aspects of the show look as good as they do. I've been very, fortunate and blessed so far with Isabeau from wagproductions.org, who, full disclosure, also happens to be my mom, who did the beautiful podcast artwork for me for free and helped me get it properly uploaded and cropped and positioned so that it looks good to help me get the show up and going. But it would be nice in future not to have to depend on friends and family to do that kind of stuff volunteer, but to actually be able to offer them at least a little honorarium, especially because when doing that kind of stuff for me for the show, as I mentioned, it's not enough. I mean, I'm not just asking someone to do something like the graphic artwork itself. I also have to ask them to do the uploading and cropping and positioning for me, because those aren't things I can do myself. I mean, of course, I can take a JPEG file and upload it, but if I want to be sure that it actually looks good, then it's best if someone sighted and with those skills does the cropping and positioning and any re-editing that's necessary. And of course, that's extra work for them beyond just the initial design and production of whatever images we're working with. Or I need to hire an extra person to help with the uploading and stuff in addition to whoever did the actual graphic design or creation of images. So that's the kind of stuff that your support via the Patreon would go for. Though, also, full disclosure, your support would really be helpful right now, because as I know I've mentioned ad nauseum in the past couple of episodes, I am moving very shortly, and it's kind of taking a crater out of my finances, as you can probably imagine. And lastly, two more quick bits of housekeeping before we get down to business. First of all, the blog section of the podcast website has finally been updated with the references and bibliographic notes from episodes 11 and 12, including, of course, links to where you can go buy Bridget's book, whom I interviewed last episode. So by all means, do go check that out. And then second of all, next month, June, will be this show's one-year anniversary. In This Labyrinth will have been on the air one whole year as of next month. So, needless to say, that is very exciting. Wow. And it's especially exciting how much the listenership has apparently grown in that year, literally from 0 to over 1,000 downloads in only 1 year and only now 13 episodes, which is just amazing. And so I'm hoping to do something a bit special to mark the one-year anniversary of the show. I'm not sure exactly what yet, and I may not even be able to do it actually during the month of June, because I'm moving just at the end of June, so next month is going to be nuts, so I might end up actually doing the something special in early July instead. But stay tuned, because hopefully it will happen, even if it happens in early July instead of June, and hopefully I'll have more actual details next episode. So yeah, stay tuned for that. And now, having gotten all that taken care of, and sorry all the housekeeping stuff took so long, we can now get down to business. So, as I said back at the beginning, in this episode, I want to finally review The Angel's Flight. And, as I mentioned earlier, it's the sequel to the book The Angel's Shadow that I reviewed way back just before Christmas. And it's the second book in what I believe is going to be a trilogy called The Angels of Music Saga by Louise Ann Bateman. And it is out now in print, ebook, and yes, once again, full cast dramatized audiobook, which, again, huge thanks and kudos to Louise Ann Bateman for doing, because A, the quality of the audiobook and the performances of the readers are once again superb, and B, it's just plain wonderful to have a phantom audiobook other than LaRue. Don't get me wrong, I love LaRue, but it's really great to have other Phantom audiobooks as well, and sadly, there really aren't enough of those out there in the world. So yeah, again, huge thanks to Louise for taking the time and effort and sheer work to put her books out in that format. And while I'm on the subject, sneak preview of something I really hope will happen in the near future, Louise and Bateman and I are trying to coordinate having her on the show. Now, don't start holding your breath yet, because I have no idea when that's going to be able to happen. Certainly not till after I finish moving next month. And then there's a whole lot of logistics to figure out and coordinate around that, because there's all kinds of technical stuff around recording long-distance calls that I've never done before, so will be a bit of an experiment. And also, she and I are in different time zones, so we're going to have to figure out how to coordinate and schedule that, because there's like 5 or 6 hours difference between us. So yeah, getting that together will take a bit of doing, but I really hope that we'll be able to make it happen sometime in the next few months. So yeah, keep your fingers or whatever crossed for that, because she and I've been chatting via Facebook for the past few months since I did the interview of Angel Shadow, and I think that'll be a really fun, exciting interview to bring you guys. So yeah, here's hoping. So getting back to The Angel's Flight, it leaves the canon POTO plot behind and begins to tell the story of what happens after the ALW musical. So we went through the canon plot of the ALW musical back in The Angel's Shadow, and now The Angel's Flight is into pure sequel territory. And, trying to give as few spoilers as possible, basically it tells the story of how the Phantom, and here again Bateman uses his name, Eric, taken from LaRue, flees Paris along with Meg and Madame Giry, and how they start a new life. And at first, they settle down in the small town near Rouen, where Eric was born and lived as a child, where he had originally hoped to settle down with Christine, but obviously that didn't happen. But that becomes unsustainable for various reasons, so ultimately Eric, Meg, and Madame Giry make their way to America. And along the way, they're drawn back into the world, well, for Eric it's back, and for the Giry's it's for the first time, into the world of traveling fairs. And also along the way, Eric slowly learns empathy and to be somewhat less harsh and domineering and to be a bit more compassionate. Although, even so, by the end of the book, you still feel like he's got a bit of a ways to go. And Meg, meanwhile, loses her virginity, falls in love, and gets married in that order. Although, sadly, none of that with or to Eric. And I might as well take the time here to say that if The Angel's Shadow was at the very least a strong PG-13, Angel's Flight definitely gets an M rating. Not so much for violence, it's no more violent than Angel's Shadow was. However, Angel's Flight does contain scenes of fairly explicit sex. So yeah, heads up on that score if that's not your thing as a reader. So, as I was saying, in this book, Meg loses her virginity, falls in love, and gets married in that order, though sadly, none of those things with or to Eric. And that's one of the things I really love and appreciate about Louise Ann Bateman's writing. Not the part where Meg doesn't fall in love with Eric, it's torture to watch poor Eric not get a love interest, but I really love and appreciate the way Bateman confounds your expectations. Wherever you think or expect her writing to go, that's not where it goes. So, yeah, I really enjoy and appreciate not being able to guess where she's going with it or guessing and being wrong. So, for example, both in Angel Shadow and this one, I keep waiting for Meg to start to develop romantic feelings or feelings of desire for Eric, and that's not where Bateman goes with it so far. If she's setting Eric up to have a love interest in this trilogy, in this series, so far, if it's going to be Meg, I'm not seeing it coming yet. And so far, I'm not seeing anyone else being set up as a possible alternate love interest to Christine either. So, yeah, I have no idea where she's going with that in terms of the love story. I mean, Eric's love story. And I have no idea where she's going with the relationship between Eric and Meg either. And as I said, that's really refreshing and delightful. I love it when I can't predict an author, especially in Phantom fanfiction. The one thing I'll say, though, is that for the next book in the series, for where it goes from here, I really hope Bateman is not going in a Love Never Dies direction, or if she is, I really hope she does a better job with the plot than Love Never Dies itself. I won't go into why right here, right now, because at some point I'm going to do a whole other episode on the small litany of issues that I have with LND. But suffice it for now to say that, don't get me wrong, the music is gorgeous. Of course it is. It's Andrew Lloyd Webber. But like many fans, I have serious issues with the plot and particularly with what LND does with the characters. And as I said, I will most definitely talk about that in depth in a future episode. But all that to say for now that if that's where Bateman's going with the next part of the series, I only hope she doesn't follow the LND plot as faithfully as she did the canon POTO plot back in Angel Shadow. And there are some Love Never Dies references, both in Angel Shadow and in this one, Angel's Flight, that do make me wonder. Getting back to the book at hand, though, one of the things that's really excellently done in Angel's Flight is the character development. Bateman brings both Meg and Eric a long way in the book, emotionally and psychologically, as well as physically and geographically. Because at the beginning of the book, although Eric's been powerfully affected and moved by Christine's compassion in the final lair at the end of the previous book, and wants to come above ground and live in the light, he really still doesn't know how to interact with people, or how to handle people in situations except through intimidation. And he doesn't really know how to empathize yet, either. He's still too caught up in his own pain to really be able to spare any sympathy for anyone else's. But throughout the book, he slowly begins to learn those things, with help and patience and perseverance from Meg and Madame Giry. He slowly learns to curb his temper and to resist the urge to shut himself away and push people away. And he even somewhat learns to negotiate rather than intimidate in order to get what he wants. And I think you can even see him begin to learn empathy. He certainly handles Meg and her issues much better by the time you get to the last few chapters of the book than he does at the beginning. He handles her much more gently and compassionately. And I should say that all this is beautifully conveyed by Ryan Kerwin, who voices Eric again here. He voiced Eric back in Angel's Shadow and does just as brilliant a job here in Angel's Flight. And obviously, I very much hope he'll be able to do the third book when it comes out as well. So then Meg, who is once again brilliantly read by the author herself, is honestly a bit of a brat at the beginning of the book. At least, she's very petulant about her and her mother having to flee Paris with Eric. Which might be understandable if it were just because of Madame Giry's involvement with Eric. But of course, all throughout the previous book, Meg totally entangled herself in Eric's business too. Even after being explicitly asked and warned not to. But now that that entanglement's resulted in her, along with her mother, having to flee with Eric to escape Paris and the gendarme, she's, as I said, kind of petulant about it, and resentful of Eric, and taking it personally as Eric trying to erase and steal her old life, rather than as what they need to do to protect themselves from the gendarme. But as the book progresses, she slowly grows out of that attitude, helped by the fact that throughout the book, she slowly comes to know more about Eric and to develop greater empathy and sympathy for him, and to develop genuine respect for him, both for his talent and as a person. Because as the book progresses, she's really able to see the effort Eric's making to learn how to actually interact with people in a civil way. And so she comes, I think, to respect him for really making that effort to change for the better. And also, because she's able to see Eric making that effort, throughout the book, Meg learns not to be afraid of him anymore. As well as all this great character development, though, I have to say that the book also seems to me to be very well researched. Granted, I'm not a historian, so there may be inaccuracies that I'm not spotting, but overall, it seems to me that Bateman's done her homework and really has a good grasp of the period. She really does a great job, I think, of bringing the period to life, as she did previously in Angel's Shadow. The other thing that Bateman does really brilliantly in this book, and perhaps even better than she does it back in Angel's Shadow, and I can't tell whether it's by design, by intention, or not, but either way, in Angel's Flight, Bateman really does a brilliant job of showing the pervasiveness of the patriarchy in that time period, and not just the patriarchy as a legal system, but as a system of thought and behavior that affected everyday life. Because part of the reason why Eric can be a bit of an asshole, especially at the beginning of the book, and why it's taking him so long to even begin to unlearn that, is not only because of the life he's known of brutality, but because he's got the idea from the patriarchy that being a man means being tough and stoic, always being in control, never showing fear or pain, and in fact never showing any strong emotion except anger, except under the most dire of circumstances, when he's pushed to the breaking point and beyond, as in the final lair. And as a result, all his pain and grief is kept bottled up and can't be expressed except in music and other artistic outlets, which, because of various circumstances throughout the plot of Angel's Flight, he doesn't always have access to. And as a result of this, as a result of what we would now today call toxic masculinity, he has a tendency to lash out, especially, as I said, toward the beginning of the book. In addition to and compounding this, the patriarchy's also given Eric to believe that as the man of the house and as Meg's sort of guardian, he's entitled to quote-unquote respect, meaning absolute obedience, and to use corporal punishment when he doesn't get that quote-unquote respect. And what Bateman portrays so brilliantly is how this understanding of what it means to be a man and to be the man of the house was considered perfectly normal at that time. Because, for example, Madame Giry and Meg don't see his stoicism and refusal to show pain or fear or vulnerability as part of the problem. They don't question that. They take that for granted as part of what a man should be. And they also agree that the man of the house deserves, quote-unquote, respect, i.e. absolute obedience, and has the right to administer corporal punishment when it's not given. I mean, yes, Madame Giry does tell Eric that he needs to learn to curb his temper, and that he should be calm when he beats Meg so that he won't accidentally go too far, but she doesn't see a father or legal male guardian administering a beating to a wayward daughter, even a nearly 18-year-old one, as inherently wrong or abusive the way we would today. So, as I said, Bateman does a really great job of showing how just taken for granted that patriarchal authoritarianism was at that time. And relatedly, Bateman also does a really great job of portraying the pervasiveness of the idea of normalcy, the ideology of normalcy, which would just really have been coming into its own in the late 19th century and beginning of the 20th century when Angel's Flight takes place. And the words normal, normalcy aren't used as such in the book, but as I said, Bateman does a really brilliant job of showing the pervasiveness of that idea. And she does so through Meg, because carried over from the previous book, one of the driving forces of Meg's character is her terror of being, quote-unquote, found out as mad. And that terror is not without reason, because, as we learned in the previous book, and it's recapped in Angel's Flight, Meg saw what happened to her father. Her father had what today would probably be diagnosed as major depression, and was confined to a lunatic asylum for a while because of it, and was subjected there to very inhumane, quote-unquote, treatments. So Meg's terrified of that happening to her, too, because she also has that depression. But what's interesting is, and we saw it back in Angel's Shadow, and we see it even more here in Angel's Flight, that although Meg is terrified, and with good reason, of the quote-unquote treatments she might be subjected to, she doesn't fundamentally disagree with the medical idea that there's something wrong with her. She sees herself as damaged and broken, and in some ways as deserving of that ultimate incarceration in a lunatic asylum, even as she dreads it. She sees it as inevitable because of what she is, in very much the same way that Eric sees himself as fundamentally damaged and broken and fated for the margins because of his face, because of his deformity. And so Meg's terror and avoidance of doctors comes not from a feeling that she's being unjustly stigmatized, but from fear that they'll detect the quote-unquote wrongness, the madness in her, which, now that I think about it, forms a really interesting parallel to Eric's terror of being unmasked and having his deformity revealed, although Meg herself doesn't make that connection. And in fact, Bateman doesn't make the connection explicitly either, which makes me wonder if it was intentional or if it just emerged as part of the storytelling. Oh, and I should say with regard to my earlier observation about how well she portrays the patriarchy, the pervasiveness of the patriarchy, it's not that there aren't characters who disagree with Eric's authoritarian way of running and managing his pretend family. There are. But Bateman does a very good job of making it clear that these characters were in the minority and their opinion was in the minority, that these were unusually forward-thinking people for that time. And indeed, Meg herself, she does object to Eric's authoritarianism, but only because he's not her real father or legal guardian, because he and Madame Giry are only pretending to be a married couple in order to keep up appearances and not raise suspicion, and their documents are all forged. And as I said earlier, especially at the beginning of the book, Meg is very resentful of that pretense, because she doesn't perhaps fully grasp the extent to which they need to hide and to distance themselves from their old identities. And so she kind of takes it as yet another twisted game of Eric's, and as him trying to steal her life, and as I said, is very resentful of it. And so she resents his authority because of that. But she makes it clear, both throughout this book and back in Angel's Shadow, that if Eric were her real father or legal guardian, not that she wants him to be, but if he were, then she would believe his authority over her and his authoritarianism was perfectly justified. She would believe he would have that absolute right as the man of the house. So, as I said, Bateman does a really excellent job portraying not only the technologies and living conditions of that period, but also the attitudes of that period, and just how pervasive and taken for granted they were. I have to say, it really had me wishing that Meg would run into some suffragettes just to wake her up to some newer and more progressive ideas. And I'd be really interested to see how Bateman's Eric would handle a bunch of suffragists and what he would think of them. On one hand, I think he'd admire their strength and courage and their sense of progress, but I also think they'd shock his sensibilities. Because, as I said, one of the things that Bateman portrays really well is how Eric has internalized a lot of ideas of the patriarchy, too. But that would be a fun encounter to read. Anyway, I know I haven't given many details of the plot. I know I've only given really the sketchiest, most bare-bones outline of the plot of this book. And that's because I've really been trying to avoid giving too many spoilers. But also, from a sheer sequence of events perspective, the plot's actually fairly simple. All the really awesome and amazing stuff in this book happens in the details and small interactions between the characters that happen between the major events of the plot, and of course, in Bateman's fantastic descriptive writing. And, as I said before, all this really comes to life beautifully in the audiobook. As I mentioned before, Louise Ann Bateman herself does a beautiful job reading Meg Giry, the main narrating voice character of the book. And of course, Ryan Kerwin once again absolutely knocks it out of the park reading the part of Eric. And the rest of the cast are all really excellent too, as are the production values. The sound quality and the editing are really well done too. Which is actually bloody impressive when you think about it, given that, as I understand it, this is basically a home studio production. So, huge kudos to Bateman and to her cast for doing such an excellent job. So, as you can tell, I really loved this book every bit as much as Angel's Shadow. The quality is as good. Certainly the quality of the production values are as good, and the quality of the writing might even be slightly better. Although that's hard to say, that's a real toss-up. They're both excellent. But I do feel like there's more confidence in Bateman's writing in this book, and maybe a refinement of her skill and craft as a writer. So yeah, I would definitely highly recommend Angel's Flight to any fans out there. Especially, I would highly recommend the audiobook version. And of course, especially if you enjoyed the previous book, Angel's Shadow. And I should say, if you haven't read Angel's Shadow yet, you should probably read it before reading this one. Angel's Flight probably can stand on its own. Like, I don't think you wouldn't understand it if you haven't read the previous book. But you'll definitely understand it and get more out of it if you have read Angel's Shadow first. Because it is, after all, not only a sequel to POTO, but a very direct sequel to Angel's Shadow. Angel's Flight quite literally picks up right where the previous book leaves off and continues the story from there. So yeah, once you've read Angel's Shadow, I would highly, highly recommend picking up Angel's Flight, its sequel, to follow it up with. And, of course, for both books, I would highly, highly recommend you pick up the audiobook versions, because they both really are superbly done. And you can find all the info for where to get Angel's Shadow in the notes, in the show notes, and in the blog post for episode 10, I believe it was. And of course, I'll put all the info for where you can get Angel's Flight, print, ebook, and of course, the fabulous audiobook, in the show notes and in the blog post for this episode as well. So hopefully, you'll all be able to easily find both of these amazing books, and both of these amazing audiobooks, because, especially if audiobooks are something that you really enjoy, I think it's important for us to support the production of these audiobooks, because it's a huge undertaking. There's an amazing amount of work that goes into producing these full cast audio dramas. And I gather from Louise Ann Bateman that it really is a labor of love. It's not something she's in any way getting rich off of or trying to get rich off of. And, as I said before, except for many, many, many versions of the D'Amatos translation of LaRue, there aren't that many Phantom-related audiobooks out there, sadly. So when a fan like Louise Ann Bateman is actually taking the trouble to not only just record her books in audiobook, but in fact do a full-cast dramatized version of them, then I think it's really great if we can all support that as much as possible. And I get that not everyone can. I get that not everyone can afford that. But if you can, then it would be really great to support that, because it's such a wonderful service to the fan community. And I'll say for myself, as a non-print reading fan, it is so, so appreciated. Because, yeah, having my computer voice read fanfiction is great, and I'm certainly glad that exists. Because otherwise, that whole realm of fanfic would be completely inaccessible to me, except when I'm able to corral friends and family to read stuff to me. So I'm certainly glad that that technology exists and is there. But when fanfics, fan novels, like Louise Ann Bateman's books, are actually read by real, non-synthesized human voices, it is so many orders of magnitude better. So, as I said, I feel like it's a really wonderful service to the fan community, and I'm so glad and grateful that Louise Ann Bateman is doing it, is producing her fan novels this way. And as I said back at the beginning, I really wish more fan authors would. I know it's a huge endeavor and a huge amount of work, but it really would be wonderful, at least I think it would really be wonderful, to have a whole archive of really good, high-quality Phantom-lit audiobooks. So, who knows, maybe that's something we can make happen someday. Anyway, I hope you've all enjoyed my perhaps slightly rambling review of The Angel's Flight by Louise Ann Bateman. And of course, I hope you'll all go out and enjoy the book itself, too. And as I said before, I'll put all the info for where you can find it in the show notes, the long description of this episode, and in the blog, in a blog post for this episode, too. So hopefully that will make it nice and easy to find. And as always, I hope this episode's given you all a lot of good stuff to think about, a lot of good food for thought. And of course, I hope you'll all tune back in for next episode, too. I haven't entirely decided yet what I'm actually going to do for next episode, whether I'll do another book review or go back to doing just a discussion topic. But hopefully it'll be something enjoyable and interesting for all of you, and hopefully something a little special, too, because as I mentioned earlier, Next episode will be this podcast's 1-year anniversary. Wow. So yeah, do stay tuned for that, and hopefully I'll be able to do something cool and interesting to mark the occasion. And of course, as always, if you have any thoughts or feedback on this episode or any other episode, or if you have ideas for topics or things you'd like me to cover and talk about on the show, or if you have an idea for an interview or you'd like to be on the show, there are lots of ways you can get in contact. You can tweet at or follow the show on Twitter at ITL Podcast, and or you can like or follow the Facebook page for the show, and or you can join the Facebook group for the show. And both the Facebook page and the group are just the full name of the show, In This Labyrinth, The Phantom of the Opera in Eric's Times and Hours. So searching that or searching just In This Labyrinth should find both of them. And I think I've got them properly linked up now, so you should be able to find the Facebook group from the Facebook page. There should be a link there. And of course, there's a link to the Facebook page from the podcast website, which is at https://inthislabyrinth.fireside.fm. And last but not least, you can send an old-fashioned email to inthislabyrinth@yahoo.com. And I should say that on the podcast website, you can leave comments on any episode or blog post. And you can also, of course, rate and review the show on iTunes and Google Play. And as always, I would be infinitely grateful if people would rate and review the show on iTunes and Google Play, because the more ratings and reviews it gets, the more it gets boosted in the algorithms, and the easier it is for folks to search and find. So that would be enormously helpful. So thank everyone once again hugely for listening. And again, I really hope you enjoyed this episode. I hope it was interesting and gave folks lots to think about, and I would love to hear your thoughts and feedback on it, as always. And I hope you'll listen again next episode for a hopefully fun, cool, and interesting 1-year anniversary show. And of course, and as always, have a fun, safe, and phantom-filled time till then. Disclaimer: the opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the presenters and do not reflect the views of the host, Andrew Lloyd Webber, Cameron McIntosh, The Really Useful Group, or any other person or entity. In addition, this podcast is not in any way affiliated with Andrew Lloyd Webber, The Really Useful Group, Cameron McIntosh, or with any other person or entity involved in the production of any version of Phantom.